One of the guys asked me about who took the eyebrow pencil off of the mirror and the kitchen cabinet and the shower glass wall and so forth. Just a word of caution on that. Be sure you use something that does come off very easily. For instance, don't use lipstick. I heard about one guy who did that and the whole project backfired, because his wife got mad at him because it was so hard to get off. Someone else suggested that one nice thing that husbands could do for their wives is to keep the lawnmower sharp. And when he mentioned that, I thought, well, also, we could probably keep the gas tank full. Well, we want to take the rest of the morning on the subject of communications, and Carol is going to come up in just a minute. I think over the years, one of the things that we have learned about communications is that if anything can be misunderstood, it will be misunderstood. And we really have to work at this matter of understanding one another. One of the things that I feel has helped us, just from a very practical standpoint in this whole area of communications, is to realize that meanings are not in words. Meanings are in people. If I say the word horse, what do you think of? Okay, let's find out. What did you think of when I said horse? What came through your mind? Four legs, okay. Ron, what did you think of?
A hay burner.
A hay burner. Okay. Mr. Rob, what did you think of?
Well, I didn't think of anything.
Okay.
I just had a visual picture of an animal.
All right. Patsy, what did you think of?
I thought of red.
Of what?
Red.
Red. Okay, well, we got five different people and almost five different answers. So the point is that meanings are not really in words. They're in people. They're the way we interpret words. For instance, if I say to you, I don't like fish. Well, there's several things I could mean by that. I could mean I don't like to go fishing. I could mean that in my childhood a fish bit me one time and I've always hated fish. I've always had something against the little critters. Neither of which are true. I love to fish. We've got a little lake 9 miles up the Queens Canyon here called Eagle Lake, and we stock it every year with rainbow trout. And once in a while, I love to go up there and wet a line and catch some trout. And I have nothing against the little critters, you know. I think they're kind of cute floating around in these aquariums that you see in restaurants and places like that. The thing I don't like about fish is I don't like to eat them. I am not a fish lover. I like to catch trout, but somebody else can eat them. But unless you know what I mean by what I say when I say I don't like fish, a totally different meaning may come through to you. So the point is that we've got to learn to understand the meaning of what people are saying to us, and especially between us as a husband and a wife. So honey, come on up and introduce us to this tremendously important subject of communications.
Can we just bow our heads in another word of silent prayer? This is such an important topic that many of the other topics that we talk about really revolve around this one. And so why don't we just bow our heads in silent prayer, and would you just ask the Lord to speak to your heart in a special way during this session? Thank you, Lord. Amen. 2 years ago, I was wandering around the Christian Booksellers Convention in Denver. the 700 booths and the mob of people. When I passed a lady who glanced at me, stepped backwards, and then turned and said, "Where are you?" And I looked at her and I said, "I'm right here." Well, I was tempted to get away from this weird person as fast as possible with her question, when I decided that I would stop and really clarify what she was meaning. Turned out she was the owner of a Christian bookstore, had glanced at my badge, which said Nav Press, had been trying to find the booth where the navigators were selling books, and so had stopped and asked me, "Where are you?" Communication is not easy. I was overheard at a Washington airport over the loudspeaker, this announcement: "Will all those Piedmont passengers who have not done so, please do so immediately." Communication is not easy. Stewardess was passing out gum just before a flight and told all of her passengers that the gum would help their ears from popping. At the end of the flight, a man came up to her and he said, "This is my first flight, and the gum did stop my ears from popping, but now how do I get the gum out of my ear?" Communication is not easy. Now, of course, when the definition of communication is anything that we communicate, and it is, in one sense, it is impossible not to communicate. When you are silent, you are communicating something, just the very fact that you don't care enough to communicate. But in the sense that we're going to use it this morning, we're talking about communication that is more than speaking, it's more than listening, and it's more than a combination of the two. Communication is the meeting of meaning. And when your meaning meets my meaning across the bridge of words and facial expressions and tones of voice and body posture and actions, then we have real communication. And we find that great many of us just do not have good, true, real communication. But friends, if there's anything that takes work, it's this. And you never can stop. Jack and I have been married now, as he told you, for almost 31 years. And we're still working at this. Of course, it's a tremendous fun time that we have working at it sometimes. But it does take work. There's a price to pay in communicating. And we'll be talking about that price. Someone has said you can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend on the amount and depth of their communication. But friends, you have to want to communicate. Both of you have to want to communicate. And so maybe where you need to start is just asking God for a renewed desire to communicate. You may have lost the desire to really know one another in depth. And the only one that's going to help you is God Himself, to give you a renewed love for that one you're living with and a desire to truly know them in depth. It has been said that it is not the ability to communicate that is lost when marriages grow apart. It is the desire to communicate that undergoes a change. When one or the other no longer wants to be understood or to be understanding, then distance will develop. Now, we do face a complex problem when we're talking about communication, because basically there are five messages involved in the communication process. Six, rather, I'm sorry. what you mean to say, what you actually say, what the other person hears, what the other person thinks he hears, what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person said about what you said. See why it gets complicated? Now, let me just illustrate with my example the other day about looking at this beautiful moon. What I meant to say was, I am feeling romantic. What I actually said was, that is a beautiful moon. What the other person heard, what Jack could have heard, is the moon is bright. What he thinks he hears could be, it's a nice night to take a walk. So what he says about what I said is, yes, it's bright enough to shoot a golf round of golf by. And what I think he said is, I don't feel romantic. And in two sentences, you see, we have completely missed each other as far as the true understanding of meaning. Now, friends, we do this all the time. And Jack, who is much better at this than I am, of saying what he means and meaning what he says, does it too. We are always speaking in coded messages to one another. We can't help it. Even though the Bible says in Matthew 5:37 in the Phillips, what you have to say, Jesus counseled, let your yes be a plain yes and your no be a plain no. Anything more than this has a taint of evil. And you see, he's talking about being plain in our speech, and this is something I need to pray about more than Jack does, so that I really will say what I mean and mean what I say. Oh, yes. All right. So it's important that we practice simple, clear, single-level speech. But, you know, Jack will come in and ask a simple question, like, what time is dinner? Now, what would you think that he meant by that? You what? He's hungry. Well, I would have thought so too, and so I would hurry up dinner. But now I've discovered that Jack is a jogger, and he likes to run before dinner sometimes. So what he may be saying is, what time is dinner? Do I have time to run before dinner? And unless I understand that, I'm hurrying up dinner when he wants it delayed. And again, we have completely missed one another as far as a meeting of meaning. Now, one of the greatest things that Jack and I are learning to do, and this has just probably been in the last 7 or 8 years, is to practice what we call the feedback technique. Some of you have read about this technique. But it's a process of telling back to the person what we think they're saying. Like when Jack says, what time is dinner? I would want to say, honey, are you saying that you're hungry or are you saying that you want to jog before dinner? To clarify meaning, constantly be asking, what do you mean? What are you really saying? Are you saying thus and so? Now, you can do this two ways. You can do this through the use of questions. For instance, if Jack said, I feel frustrated. I might say, using this technique, are you feeling that way because of something I've done? That'd be my natural reaction. You know, it's my fault. He might say, no, I'm feeling frustrated about my job. Well, are you feeling stymied by the other people? That they're not letting you get done what you want to get done? Well, not exactly. Well, is it that you're not able to accomplish what you want, or what is it exactly? Well, I just don't have clear direction in my job right now. Oh, well, how can I pray for you on that? And see, now we're getting down to what he's really meaning. But friends, how often we just let go at that, don't we? Or your mate will say, I feel frustrated, and you will think, oh, it's something I've done. And you don't even want to ask because you're afraid he'll hurt you if you ask. And you don't get down to where we're really living. You're not communicating in heart. Now, believe it or not, there are some people who feel that any question is a threatening question. There's a good book, by the way, a couple of good books. One called Caring Enough to Confront by Dave Augsburger talks about this, and also Why I Am Afraid to Tell You Who I Am by John Powell are both good books on what I'm talking about right now, and we'll elaborate. By the way, one of the most tremendous ways to really communicate is to read a book like that out loud together. Jack and I do this a lot when we're driving. I don't get car sick, so we can do this and really talk a lot in depth just as we're driving along together. But Mr. Augsburger suggests that you go a whole week without asking a question because of people who do feel threatened when you ask, what do you mean, even? Now, I'm awfully glad Jack isn't like that because it would be very hard for me to get down to the depth of things without asking questions. But you can restate it. Friends, this takes practice. But, oh, the rewards of really working at this are monumental. Now, let me illustrate. I might say, I seem to be tired all the time lately. Now, the question will be, why? Why are you tired? What is making you tired? But restate it. Yes, I've noticed that you don't have the energy you usually do. That encourages more response, you see. Well, after supper, I just feel like I'm like giving up and going to bed, I might say. And Jack might come back with, I wonder if the children are demanding too much time. See, it's an I wonder or I feel rather than a direct question. Totally non-threatening. And so work on that as far as thinking through and restating what you think they're saying without questioning and then also with questions if someone does not feel threatened on it. Communication takes commitment. It takes commitment to reveal yourself, friends. And it takes commitment in time. We all fall into a basic category, probably of being a concealer of our feelings or a revealer of our feelings. Now, Jack and I aren't at opposite poles on this one, but we're probably about here. It is much easier for me to reveal my feelings than it is for Jack to reveal his. I once read about a man that was definitely a concealer. And he went through some steps on this. He recognized that his silence was selfishness and that it did not show his wife, who longed for deeper communication, real love. So he confessed the selfishness to God. He confessed that it was sin. And he realized that love was not a feeling but a decision. See, love is an act of your will, friends. And he made the decision that by God's grace, he was going to be a good communicator, no matter what it cost. Now, somewhere along the line, Jack has done that. And I doubt if he went all through those steps. But somewhere along the line, Jack determined in his heart that he was going to learn how to dredge deep in his feelings and bring them out and somehow be able to express them to me. And oh, I've been so grateful for that. Because it has deepened our relationship to the place where we really are best friends. And we feel like we know one another's hearts. Not just thoughts, but hearts. But as I said, that takes commitment. With some of you, it's going to take some forgiveness. Because with some, you have built walls and walls and walls through the years because you've been hurt when you've tried to do this. Now, one of the great barriers of this is ridicule. See, if Jack, through the years, I'm kind of a nut. You can tell that, I'm sure. And I have a lot of just crazy ideas that I spill over. Now, if over the years I had spilled some of these ideas over to Jack, he had looked at me and he says, honey, that is absolutely stupid. What would have happened? Well, I would have clammed up, wouldn't I? And the more he ridiculed my ideas, the more I would have clammed up. Until today, probably, we wouldn't even really be communicating on anything but a surface level. But because Jack has never ridiculed me, I'm sure many times he's thought, what a stupid idea. But he's never said it. And so he has freed me to be me. And in so doing, he gets the benefit of my 1 out of 1,000, maybe, ideas that make sense. But more than that, it has drawn us closer together. Now, some of you are at a place where you're having to ask God to tear down the walls because you're not trusting one another. You have been ridiculed. And in order to break down those walls, you're going to have to go to the Lord and say, Lord, I can't trust him or I can't trust her because I've been hurt so often. But I can trust you. And so, will you help me to tear down those walls? Will you tear them down? Help me to really forgive and forget. Only God can help you do that. And help us to start again without any walls. You know, today really is the first day of the rest of your life. And it's the first day of the rest of your marriage. And God wants to make things new and precious and beautiful in your life and in your relationship with one another. He really does, and he can, if you give him all the pieces. So commit yourself to being a communicator, a revealer of your feelings. Now, Jack will never be as free as I am, and that's something I have to accept, don't I? I mean, some of you men are sitting there, and some of you women maybe are saying, well, you know, he married me, that's the way I am, and that's the way I'll always be. He knew that when he married me, or she knew that when she married me. Oh, no, friends. God is in the business of changing us. God is in the business of perfecting us. And yet, in a sense, that is true, that though Jack has worked on this and worked on this, he's never going to be a kind of that can blurt it all out like I can. And that's okay. That part I accept as we work on these together. Now, there are some very great barriers in the communication process, and you may be guilty of some of these. And I'm just going to use the illustration of Sue and Elmer to bring up some of these barriers. One evening, Sue said to Elmer, Elmer, I'd like to talk to you about something that's been bothering me lately. And Elmer responded with, not now, Sue. There's a ball game on TV, and I want to watch it. Let's talk about it later. But later, Elmer had to do his tax return, make an important phone call, and after that, he was just too tired. He had very effectively blocked any real communication by being too busy. Now, friends, this is very common in our busy lives today, isn't it? We're just too busy to really communicate on a depth level. This is one of the prices, by the way, that we pay for true communication. Maybe sometimes lack of sleep. Maybe time with that TV turned off, even if it's your favorite program. But it costs in time. And we must not be too busy. 2 weeks later, Elmer became home discouraged and upset. He'd been wrestling with some personnel problems at work and wanted to talk about them with his wife. But just as they got the conversation started, Sue interrupted, honey, did you remember to pay the water bill yesterday? She had effectively indicated to him that she wasn't interested in his problems at work. And later she complained that he never discussed his job with her. But wives, you and I have been guilty of that one how many times? We got something else on our mind and we just changed the subject. So Elmer carried his problems alone. But the personnel problems did not dissolve, and he became irritable. One night, he tried to reach Sue again and said, Sue, you don't seem very interested in my problems at work. In quick succession, she looked stricken, hurt, and finally angry. She exploded. You don't think so? Well, you don't listen to me either. How many times have I tried to tell you something and you just keep right on reading your old paper? Don't talk to me about not listening. Friends, this is a very natural response, isn't it? I mean, when we're hurt, we hurt back. Very immature response, but a very natural response. And a very wrong response. She has effectively blocked communication by her defensiveness. You see, Sue needed God's grace to respond with, "You're right, honey. I'm sorry. Tell me what it is I can do and how I can help you. I do want to listen, and I am interested in your problems. Please forgive me." So Sue's defensiveness caused Elmer to drop the subject and grow more silent and depressed. A week later, Sue said, "Elmer, you've only spent 15 minutes with the kids this week, and even less time with me. I really feel the need for more of your time." And Elmer's response was, "You're absolutely right. I am the world's worst father and husband. I don't know how you put up with me. I'm just a total failure." Did you ever respond that way? You know what that is? It's called super guilt. Now, Dr. Mallory of the Elantra Christian Counseling Center suggests that when this is our response, that we have absolutely no intention of changing. Because if we had any intention of changing, we wouldn't need to feel that guilty. Now, of course, what's your response to that kind of a thing? You withdraw, because they're not that bad. So you stop talking about it. You think, "Oh, I've made them feel so bad, and I didn't mean to make them feel so bad, so I won't talk about it anymore." And that's exactly what they wanted. Oh, friends, we'll have to take time to do it tomorrow, but we've got to talk about things. We've got to learn as Christians to work through conflict in a mature way. And by the way, the book of Proverbs is the very best book you can study and read to learn how to really handle conflict. Conflict is healthy in a marriage, even conflict about conflict. But it is how you handle it that is absolutely vital. A variation of the super guilt is the person who gives in on everything. And when the wife says, "Honey, the kids you're not spending enough time with the kids," you say, "That's absolutely right, but you don't do anything about it." And you just give in on everything and you never work through conflict. And that, of course, is peace at any price. Eventually, this leads to such repressed feelings of frustration in both husband and wife that joy is gone from the relationship and their communication is crushed. Busy husbands can very especially be guilty of this one. They're just too busy to deal with things. And so they just peace at any price. 2 days later, Elmer said to Sue, "You know, I really am feeling like a failure in my work. And as a husband and father, I feel very ineffective in my life right now." Now he's getting down to where he's living. Now he's expressing feelings. But Sue comes back with, "Oh, you shouldn't feel that way. It's dumb to feel that way." Friends, how many times have you and I said to someone, "Oh, don't feel that way"? I bet you've done it this week. Just don't feel that way. Well, the problem is, they do feel that way, and you haven't helped one single bit. You have denied their feelings. And in denying their feelings, have blocked their expression of feelings later on. One of the best methods I use to block communication is silence used as a tool. Now, this is something I need prayer for. I need to really work at this because it's wrong. Someone has said that the little phrase, nothing is wrong, is a phrase that should be stricken from any married couple's vocabulary. But we use it, don't we? Jack can read me like a book. And I have a very expressive face anyway, so he comes in the door and he's done something that I haven't liked. And I've probably been stewing at it all day. And so instead of greeting him effusively with a kiss or something, it's just very distant, sort of, hi, honey. And he says, honey, what's the matter? Nothing. Come on now, I can tell. Something's the matter. What is it? Never mind. And you see, bless his heart, he knows by now that he's got to keep asking me, because if he doesn't, I get worse. And so, but that's what I'm forcing him to do, you see. I'm using it. I'm using silence as a tool to punish him. And that is wrong. It's immature. And God is helping me. What do I need to do? Well, I need to just say, honey, there is something the matter. It doesn't have anything to do with you. I just need to get some time alone with the Lord and get my attitude straightened out, and then I'll tell you. Or I need to say, honey, there is something wrong, and it does have something to do with you, but if I start to tell you about it right now, I'm going to cry. That's my little trick. I can't help it. But let's come back to it. That's the secret, coming back to it. Or I need to say, this is what it is, and really keep short accounts, and let him off the hook. Now, in my natural person, this is impossible for me to do. But with God, friends, nothing is impossible. And God can really help us. Take all of these defenses and get rid of them. God can teach us how to communicate. But God cannot teach us how to communicate if he's up there. He has got to be here in my life. We've got to let him invade our lives and really be God to us. And there may be a few of you out there who God's still up there. He's not really here in my life. And I'd like to just take a few minutes, tell you a little story, so that you will be able to see how God stops being the God up there and be the God right here in my life. Jack and I lived in the Chicago area for 14 years before we moved to this beautiful state. And as you know, the Chicago area is just one little suburb right up after another. And we lived in a northwestern suburb, and I was supposed to have lunch with a friend of mine at a place called Deer Path Inn. And she had given me directions from my home. Somehow I got it in my head that Deer Path Inn was in the suburb of Deerfield. They both started with deer, so I thought that's where it was. Turned out it was in three or four suburbs north of Deerfield. And I started out at a place from a different place than she had given me directions. And I started out at a road called Green Bay Road. And I drove, and I drove, and I drove, and I drove, and I drove. And I couldn't find Illinois Road, the street that she had told me to turn off on. By this time, I was late, getting a little frantic. So I did what sometimes men have a little difficult time doing. I got off and asked directions. And so I went into this filling station and I said, help, I'm lost. And he said, well, where are you going? And I said, Deer Path Inn. Oh, okay, he said. Let's see, go 10 blocks that way and 2 blocks that way. No. No, better way to go is 4 blocks that way and 15 blocks that... No, no. Well, he told me 3 different ways to go, and by this time I was hopelessly confused. There was a nicely dressed gentleman standing there taking this all in. Finally, he turned to me and he said, would you like to follow me? And I thought, whew. And the man, the filling station attendant, said, well, are you going to Deer Path Inn? And this man said, no, but I live in Lake Bluff and I could go right by there and I would be happy to show this lady the way. So he hopped in his car and I hopped in mine, and away we went, entirely a different direction than the 3 ways this man had directed me. Well, friends, we went on the littlest, awfulest, squiggliest, backest roads you ever saw in your life. And you can imagine what was going through my head. Where is he taking me? And what is he going to do to me when he gets me there? But by this time, I was so hopelessly committed to wherever he was taking me, I was so lost, that I had to follow him. It seemed like an eternity, but was only a few short moments, I'm sure, when we pulled onto Illinois Road and pulled up in front of Deerpath Inn. And this gentleman was so kind as to get out of his car and come over to mine and poke his head in my window and say, "Now, do you think you can find your way back?" And I assured him that my friend would help me. As I got to thinking about that, I thought, how like life. We get started on the path of life. And at least if you're anything like I was, you know pretty much what you want out of life and where you're going, where you're headed. Of course, in my generation, it was kind of like you get married and live happily ever after, and that was the end for me instead of the beginning. But I thought I had it pretty well figured out. But then the further we go, the more we begin to realize that we aren't all that sure of where we're going, on what we really want out of life. Sometimes it takes the form of an illness, a death of someone we love, a marriage that isn't turning out the way we want, a child who is all fouled up, or perhaps it's just a depressed spirit, something within our hearts that makes us realize the emptiness that's there and the fact that there's got to be more to life than we are experiencing. But we discover that we're really lost on the way to life. And you know, we're not only lost on the way as far as knowing the direction, but basically we're really lost to God Himself. And so we start asking directions like I did that day. And we get very confused directions, don't we? We women, we're told as we read books, and we're told that what's really going to fulfill us is that we should get more education, that we should have a career, do our own thing, and that's going to fulfill our lives. So we may try that, and it may be a partial answer to some. Or we may read about the Marilyn Monroes of this world who had all that and committed suicide. And we realize that, no, there's more to it than that. And that isn't the answer. And then we read a Phyllis McGinley or someone like that who says, no, the answer is to immerse yourself in your husband and in your home and in your children, and that will fulfill your life. Now, friends, I could stand up here and tell you that if that was going to be what would fulfill my life would be totally fulfilled in Jack because he is terrific. Of course, you're looking at a stubborn Dutchman. My name was Hooksema before I was married. And I know that except for what God has taught Jack and me, that we would have been divorced long ago. So I can't tell you that, you know, I did that all myself. But I can tell you that right now, he's terrific, and he is a tremendous need meter of my life. And yet, there God, I've realized, created no human being to meet the needs of my life or your life. And I've seen marriages destroyed because one person was pushing that other person to meet needs that that person couldn't ever meet, wasn't created to meet. And the more you pushed, the more the person backed up. And something happened that destroyed a marriage that could potentially be very beautiful. Because there really is a God-shaped vacuum in every human heart that only God can fill. We get confused directions. And then we confront someone who looks at us very tenderly and says, "Would you like to follow me?" And I'm speaking, of course, of the Lord Jesus Christ. Because at some time in our lives, he's going to confront us. And he's going to ask us that question, "Would you like to follow me?" Now, when he confronted me, I had to make a value judgment, and so do you. Just as that day that man asked me the question, I had to make a value judgment of whether that man was going to be able to take me where I needed to go. Something of the same is true with Jesus Christ. Because he made some astounding claims, didn't he? He claimed to be God in human form. He claimed to be able to give us not just eternal life forever, but life on a higher plane right here and now. He claimed to be able to give us joy and deep peace in our hearts and to help us have the kind of relationships that we want today. He claimed to be able to forgive my sins and to start me in a brand new life. Now, how could he do that? See, you have to really make a value judgment. And as I looked at him, I realized that he could do that for me because he is God. And while a righteous God demands payment for all the icky things that I have done, and a righteous God looks at me and says, Carol, all those things that you have done demand payment. And I have declared that the wages of your sin is death, separation from myself. Because I, as a holy and just God, have to demand payment, and that has to be paid. That penalty has to be paid. And I stand there guilty and condemned. But then Jesus Christ steps forward and he says, but Father, remember, 2,000 years ago, I, as a part of you, came down here to this earth and I lived a perfect life, a life that demanded no penalty at the end of my life. I lived a holy life that met all of your standards and your requirements for righteousness. And I could have come back to you without dying, without being separated. But I died. I died a very cruel death on the cross. And I did it for Carol. And I did it for you. And I did it for you. And the Father says, of course I remember. And then he turns to me and he says, Carol, what will you do with what my son has sacrificed for you? And I have a choice, don't I? I can fall on my face, in my heart anyway, and say, oh, thank you. Thank you for doing that for me. Thank you for dying for my sins. And at that moment, I become a brand new creature in Christ. I become a child of God, born anew spiritually. Or I can say, well, thank you, but I'll try it my own way. And then Christ looks at me and he says, oh, Carol, there is no other way. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. But I did that. Years ago, I said yes to Jesus Christ, who is the eternal yes in my life. And as he came into my life, he gave me all the riches that are in him that I haven't discovered them all yet. But he gave me a brand new life. And instead of being the God out there, he is the God right here in my heart and in my life who wants to do such great things right now and through all eternity. I'm going to quit there, Jack. There's much more in communications, but we'll come back to it.
Let me just try and finish up a couple of things on communications. We may need to come back to it a little bit in the morning. One of the practical things that Carol and I have learned that have really helped us over the years in this matter of communications is two things that we try to practice regularly. One is that we still go out on dates. And our goal is one date a week, just the two of us. We don't double date in this particular situation because our objective is communications. Our objective is to get away from the telephone, away from the house, away from people stopping by, and the interruptions that can occur at home. and have time together where we can talk about things that maybe we just haven't gotten around to in the past week. And sometimes it'll be, you know, a nice meal. Sometimes it'll be pizza, or sometimes it'll be just hamburgers. But out away from things. And if you have not tried that, now maybe once a week is too much for you. We don't always make it once a week, but that's our goal. And we find that those times are a very high time and peak time for us to talk about things that maybe we've neglected. We get caught up on one another's thinking and the problems that we're facing and some of the concerns that we have on our hearts, and sharing with one another some of the things that we've gotten from the Word recently, or what God is speaking to our hearts about, or what is the number one prayer request that we have during these days. And we just sit and talk for several hours. Another thing that we have started doing just in the last... Now, we've been doing that ever since we've been married. But something that we've started doing just, I'd say, in the last 10 or 12 years that we've made a commitment to one another on is that we will spend 20 minutes to a half hour every day talking to one another. And we set a time to do that. Usually, now as our time situation has changed, we've had to change when that time would be. Right now, for us, the best time to do that is over dinner. About 5 years ago, because of Carol's schedule and my schedule, it was breakfast time. But now it's dinner. And so after dinner is over, you know, in normal circumstances, when I'm home and in town and Carol's home and in town, we'll just linger over a cup of coffee or a glass of iced tea and spend 20 minutes to a half an hour just conversing with one another. And it's an appointment that we have with each other. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that's the only time we talk to each other. But what I am saying is that we are committed to talk every day. And if we don't get any other time to do it, we do do it then. Might be something you want to give some thought to. Because communication takes a price to pay. And part of that price is time. Another price, as Carol may have mentioned, is keeping the TV off. You can't communicate when that dumb boob tube is rattling away. It's most of the time nonsense. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not knocking TV if you're in the TV business. I enjoyed immensely this last weekend in the U.S. Open. And, let me just mention a couple of nevers that we have discovered over the years, and in talking to other couples, this has been a very practical thing in the area of communication. Nevers in the area of communication. Never use sarcasm in kidding or joking with one another. Now, if you're not exactly sure what I mean by sarcasm, if you've ever seen Don Rickles on television or perform sometime, he is the master craftsman of the use of the sarcastic joke. He makes a living by it. But if you also notice, Rickles has perfected the art to the point of where it is tremendously cutting. Well, early in our marriage, we developed this little habit of kidding and joking with one another in a sarcastic way. And it was sort of fun and cute in the early days of this, and we enjoyed it, and we had fun with it. But after a year or a year and a half had rolled by, we found that we were beginning from time to time to really use the sarcastic joke as a way of getting at the other person in an indirect way. And it really wasn't a joke. There was something real in it, and therefore it was a barbed remark. And we also discovered that we were hurting each other. This would come out from time to time. And about 2 years into our marriage, we spent the summer in California. I was a youth director in a church out there just for the summer, and we worked with a very delightful couple, a pastor and his wife. And over the course of the summer, we had the opportunity to spend many, many hours with them, and they had a terrific relationship. And about halfway through the summer, Carol and I, independent of one another, had noticed that even though they kidded with each other, they had their own little pet way of joking and pulling one another's leg, as you might call it, they had a great time together, but they never used sarcasm. And that became very obvious to both of us because we had fallen into this habit. We knew that it was hurting our relationship, but we didn't know what to do about it. And one night, we talked about this together, and we decided that we would ask them about it. And so we were out to dinner with them in just a few days later, and we brought this subject up, and we asked them. We said, we know you have a great time together, but we've noticed in the several weeks that we've been around that you never kid each other sarcastically. Well, they virtually repeated our own story back to us, that in the early days of their marriage, they were doing this. It grew and got such a habit that they realized they were hurting each other. And they talked about it one night. They committed themselves to one another that they would stop it. They spent time in prayer together about it. And they said it took us several weeks to break the habit because it was so ingrained in us. It was so a part. It was so natural a response. And like us, they had gotten to the point where it was kind of, can you top this type of thing? And that's the way Carol and I had gotten, you know. She'd make some sarcastic remark, and then I'd feel I had to top her. And so I'd try to come back, and then she would come back. Well, we went home that night and talked about it for a lengthy time. And we committed to one another that we were going to put this out of our lives. We got down on our knees together. We prayed about it together and asked the Lord to help us. And we even ask one another to help us, for me to help her and for her to help me, because sometimes we were totally unconscious that we had just made a sarcastic remark. And so for several weeks, you know, that was a little tough to take. I would, you know, lip off and I'd make some sarcastic remark about her and she'd say, honey, that hurt. Oh, I'm sorry. But gradually it faded. And then it was gone. Now, what I am saying is, you may be able to handle this. On the other hand, as you think about it, and if this has become a habit in your life, and you know that it is beginning to hurt your relationship, and you're hurting each other, folks, it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. There are other ways of having fun and kidding with one another than hurting one another. So if you can't handle it, the thing that we would suggest is eliminate it from your communication pattern. We can't handle it. But you have to make that decision for yourself. Another thing that is probably one of the most common habits among married couples of anything we have ever seen, and this again is a never. Never criticize or correct him or her in public. Never criticize or correct him or her in public. The husband and wife have been over to a friend's home for dinner, and as they're leaving, the husband turns to the hostess and says, "Thanks so much for inviting us over. It was a delightful dinner, such a welcome change from TV dinners." Funny? Yeah. Kind? No. Or the husband is getting directions or trying to get them, and he says, "Well, you better tell me. Jeannie could get lost with a police escort." Funny? Yes. Kind? No. Never criticize or correct him or her in public. How many times have you been in a group of couples, and it's just a social time together, and you're having a good time, and it gets to be storytelling time? And so this particular wife is trying to encourage her husband to tell his favorite story, and it is really a humdinger. He thinks it's good. She thinks it's good. It's gone over everywhere they've ever been. And he is kind of reluctant, but finally he gives in after much coaxing and encouraging from his wife. And so he starts in to tell his favorite story, and he gets about three paragraphs into it, and he embellishes just a little bit. He adds a little bit to it. And she comes in, "Now, honey, don't get carried away. Remember." And then she, you know, tells him how he did it the last time. And so he simmers down a little bit, and he keeps going, and a couple of more paragraphs, he leaves something out. Well, after all, it's his story. And she reminds him of what he has left out. Well, that happens about three times. And then with disgust in his voice, he turns to her and he says, "Well, why don't you tell it?" Never criticize or correct him or her in public. One time we had a men's conference up at Green Lake, Wisconsin. There were 987 men at that weekend conference over Thanksgiving weekend. It was a fantastic time, one of the most explosive and exciting experiences at a conference that I have ever had. God really worked. And, of course, when I got home, I took more than 10 minutes to tell Carol about it. And I waxed eloquent on that one. Well, a week or so later, I was eavesdropping on a conversation that she was having with a group of gals that she was telling about this great conference the guys had up at Green Lake, and that there were just over 1,000 men there, among other things she was saying. There were just over 1,000 men there, and I thought to myself, now wait a minute. There were 987 men there. That isn't just over 1,000. That's just under 1,000. Now, I had a very important decision to make at that point. Should I break into the conversation and let those gals know that it wasn't just over 1,000, it was just under 1,000? In fact, girls, if you really want to know the truth, it was 987. I mean, my perfectionist tendencies, you know. Let's get it right. But I think one of the things I've learned over the years in that kind of a situation is to take what I call the 20-year look. In other words, 20 years from now, will it make any difference to that little group of gals whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000? And as I thought about it, I had to conclude that 20 years from now, it really wouldn't make any difference. And so I kept my big mouth shut. But you know, I've seen couples who cannot refrain from correcting their mates in that kind of a situation when they get something just a little bit wrong. Now, Carol is a writer, and her mother was a writer, and I have learned one thing about authors. I've known several of them, and that they have a tendency to embellish things, and sometimes they leave things out. It all depends on the aesthetic value and what is needed subjectively here. I love her for it. And we have quite a kick out of her statistical information. I mean, sometimes, you know, she just pulls out of the air 80% of something or other. And, you know, it could have been 75, it could have been 40. But it's 80. It just happens to come out 80. Well, what difference does it make? The 20-year look. Never criticize or correct him or her in public. You see, I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. And because of that, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people when we're around other people. Now, the reason, however, the real reason that I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club is not just because she is such a fantastic gal and a wonderful wife and a good mother and a wonderful lover and an author and talented, and she can play the piano, she can write books, you know, and all this jazz. She's a good cook, fantastic cook. She's a great tennis player. None of those reasons are the real reason why I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. The real reason is this. It's because I truly, deeply love her. And because I love her, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people. And therefore, together, the two of us work at this matter of not criticizing or correcting one another in public. Now, you know, if something comes up and we're with a group of people and I say something or she says something and it's really out to lunch, I mean, it really is wrong, and if it's repeated again, it's going to do damage. Well, when we get home, well, we correct each other. Or we'll get one another off to the side and say, honey, did you realize this is what you'd said? But not in front of other people. Okay. No, I got to quit. It's dinner time. I mean, lunchtime. Okay, well, we'll take a few more minutes in the morning and finish up on this. And have a great afternoon and evening today, huh? Thank you very much. Yeah.